Just to be sure you've got the right panel, this is How Brain Science Turns Browsers into Buyers. A little bit of housekeeping initially here. If you're on Twitter, the hashtag for this particular event is BrainBuy. We have four panelists, and all of their Twitter handles are their names. So you've got AK Pradeep, Derek Halper, and Roger Dooley. The only exception is Brian Clark, whose handle is CopyBlogger. So very simple. And if you are tweeting, feel free to reference the name of the panelist, too. Let's start off with a brief intro here. Most marketing fails. This guy is John Wanamaker, a department store magnate. He's not really remembered for too much these days other than noting that half his advertising was wasted. He just didn't know which half. And actually, he guessed too low. 95% of all new products fail. 98% of direct mail offers get no response. And similarly, 98% of direct response emails simply do not convert. And some of you folks might say, well, hey, I do better than that. These are DMA numbers, and they are typical of the industry as a whole. Even worse, when you look at big dollar ad campaigns, 20% of them have zero brand lift. They fail to move the needle in terms of brand perception. Another 20% actually have a negative brand impact, or at least are accompanied by a decline in brand perception. And why is that? This is the obligatory iceberg shot. Any neuromarketing presentation has to have a picture of an iceberg. And the reason is it's such an excellent metaphor for how our brain works. About 95% of our decision-making is subconscious. And that poses a real challenge because if your marketing is the Titanic and it meets that iceberg of the subconscious, we know what happens from there. One solution to this subconscious decision-making problem is neuromarketing. And it's kind of a general term, at least I define it in a very general sense, really sort of two components. There's the hard neuroscience where you've got people doing EEG work, fMRI studies, sort of the hard neuroscience side of neuromarketing. And then there's a lot of work being done in behavioral science, social sciences, and so on, that are a lot softer, but still very relevant to getting at how our subconscious works. And we've got four panelists here, and we're going to sort of run the gamut. I don't know exactly what each one is doing, but we've had some quick conversations, and I think we're going to go from sort of the harder neuroscience side with Dr. Pradeep to more of the social side with Derek. So I'm going to segue briefly. Our format will be a brief presentation by each of us and then some audience Q&A. And from the size of the audience, I don't think we'll have a problem fielding questions. Some of you folks may remember Minority Report. And what I'm going to do is cover two quick ideas here. That's really all we have time for, where Tom Cruise was presented with all these personalized ads as he walked through a mall. And first, we have a question. Brian, what's your cola preference?
Pepsi.
Pepsi. Okay, good. And if we want to make Brian like Coca-Cola, we could show him a billboard of Coca-Cola, and that might not be particularly persuasive if he's a Pepsi drinker. But there's some interesting research that was done recently that showed if we put Brian in that simulated billboard showing him drink... it's an older picture. Sorry about that, Brian. Showing him consuming a Coke, that his... perception of that brand and his preference for that brand will increase, even though he's fully aware that it's a crude simulation, maybe not quite as crude as that one. It's called the doppelganger effect, and this was the subject of some very recent research that showed putting people, showing people themselves doing something or consuming a brand caused a preference. And I think that's an area that many marketers miss. One thing that people have been doing for quite a few years is what's called personalized video. One really cool example is something called Bunnies at Home. It's a promotion for Playboy, sort of a viral promo. And what it does is it shows you upload a picture and a name, and it embeds, in this case, Derek, right in that video where they're talking about Derek and how much they like him. One of them even has a Derek tattoo. A personalized locket with Derek's picture in it. I mean, it's... And finally, the video closes with her giving the locket a little kiss. I added the thought balloon. That is not in the video. If you want to check it out, search Viral Bunnies at Home or check out that YouTube. If anybody needs a copy of my presentation, just ping me after and give you the slides. Another example, rather an old one, involved Dexter, promotion for Dexter, the TV series, in which you uploaded just a little bit of information about somebody, and it made them appear to be the target of a copycat killer. See, we've got Aggie Pradeep here, all this personalization, like works in marketing, and strangely, the supposed killer, the killer suspect, looks like the same guy in that last video. Check it out at thedexterhitlist.com if you want to see it. That's an old one, but this is something, these are all sort of viral things, but they're not really made to promote a particular product or brand. Something that I've been following recently is a work in the higher ed area that's using personalized video, and we're getting closer to doppelganger effect type marketing here, where in this case it shows the person's name, which they enter in a variety of contexts, in this case showing that I'm now a successful clinical psychologist. I think that the real future of this area, though, is what I call social personalization. Instead of requiring people to upload a photo and enter data and so on, doing it more or less seamlessly and automatically. I was on LinkedIn not too long ago, and this ad popped up, which was really got my attention because it had my picture in it and was over in the right-hand ad block. And not only that, it had me as a the proud holder of this new job for a company that I was only slightly familiar with. That's very attention-getting. It put me right in the ad, which got my attention, also in that job. So if I was looking for a job, that would have been a very powerful sort of ad and very simple to do because it was on LinkedIn. They used a combination of my photo and my work history to come up with a relatively appropriate position. Another higher ed example is for St. Bonaventure University, where if you connect with Facebook, you see all these really interesting personalization elements. They use the profile photo. They pull other photos of friends and so on. They use the name. And as you go through this little microsite, becomingextraordinary.net, it even populates things like your high school, your hometown. And there's no attention called to this. It just sort of happens. So you sort of go on an Easter egg hunt throughout the site. And I think that looking at the doppelganger effect here, the really cool part is they actually show a student ID with my photo and name on it. And if you want to see a really good example of this type of video, this is not an ad video. Again, it's more of a viral type video, but check out TakeThisLollipop.com, where you've got a serial killer who appears to be browsing your Facebook profile, looking at your photos of your friends and so on, getting into his car with your picture taped to his dashboard. And I think the real untapped opportunity here is to actually put your customer in the ad. And with that, you can accomplish something that you can't do simply by talking at somebody. Second quicker point is, anybody in this room sell products to at least some guys? Okay, lots of folks. Okay. There's a lot of research that shows guys primed with a picture of an attractive woman become impatient and short-term oriented. And what that may or may not be a surprise to you, but the actionable part there for somebody who's marketing and wants to convert is that you can actually change the behavior of your viewer. A big test, 50,000 direct mail pieces by a South African bank who was doing loan offers, tested a variety of variables, and they found that including a picture of an attractive woman in their ad was equivalent to a 4% lower interest rate in their offer. So if you're the bank marketing folks, look at that. You can stimulate response by either dropping your interest rate by 4 points, which is no small thing for a bank, or simply by including a vaguely relevant or irrelevant photo of an attractive female. This only works on guys, by the way. And I just got back from the conversion conference, and the company there, Ion Interactive, saw my presentation and called this very recent test of theirs to my attention. It was testing a video game sign-up, an online game. There were three conditions. There was the sort of the control, which is sort of this bland thing with a form. Then they tested two versions, one with a headshot of this sort of strange vampire girl, and then one that exposed a little bit more. Anyone care to guess which one worked? The photo that exposed more cleavage actually nearly doubled the response rate from pay-per-click ads, and it was about 35% higher even than the headshot. And what was happening here, they did a few things. First of all, they did get rid of a couple of irrelevant form blocks. Anytime you can reduce the number of elements in a form, you are going to improve your conversion. But the combination of the attractive female and the immediate gratification of play now, I think, was really the potent part of that. And so the takeaway there is, if you want to convert more guys, use these sort of mating triggers. You can read more about that in Jeffrey Miller's books, Mating Mind and Spent. It's an evolutionary psychology thing, but a powerful tool. And for you ladies, the good thing is you're a lot smarter than guys. You are largely unaffected by photo cues of either guys, girls. It's a much smaller effect. And that's the end of my presentation. And next up, I'm going to introduce Derek Halpern. He's the founder of Social Triggers and works at the intersection of psychology and neuroscience to get more leads and convert those leads into purchasers. Derek?
All right. What's up, everyone? So let me just start this off really easily. Raise your hand if you're currently creating content as a way to attracting leads and sales on the web. All right, now keep your hand up if you're creating solely text content. Is it a majority of text content? Raise your hand if it's a majority of text. Okay. So here's something that's very interesting when it comes to text content. Nobody thinks about how text looks on the web. People always focus on what the text says. But when it comes to text, what people want is not necessarily what they need or what's best. And today I'm going to share with you some interesting insights about how text works on the web. And then I'm going to provide with you with a technique that you can use for all of your text content to increase, to leverage your existing subscriber base and customer base to get more organic leads and sales for free. All right, so first I want to start off with a few studies. All right, remember, what is necessarily best is not what is necessarily what people want. Okay, and a slight tweak in your text, a small tweak, can have a drastic impact. The first study I want to share with you today is about how wide your text should be, like your content column. Most people have content columns that are 600 pixels wide or so, you know, takes up, say, 75% of the screen. And studies have shown that when people look at content on the web, they almost universally prefer smaller widths of content. They prefer shorter widths of content, much like a newspaper. Now, in the same regard, while they prefer the shorter widths of content, they actually read longer, wider widths of content faster. What people want is shorter width, or so smaller widths. What's more preferable is a wider width. Now, why do people prefer shorter widths if they read wider widths? Why do they prefer shorter to longer? Well, the research has shown that when they surveyed their participants, they found that people swear they read thin content faster than wider content, even though the reverse is true. Now think about that for a second. What people want isn't necessarily what's best. People want thin content, not wide content, because they believe that they can read that faster. That's the first paradox. And this is all building up to what I call the paradox of text on the web. All right, people prefer thin over wide. Now what's another thing that people prefer when it comes to text on the web? Well, let's talk about fonts for a second. Okay, when you're looking at fonts, people want an easy-to-read font. They want something like Verdana, Arial, they want Georgia. They want something that's nice and easy to read. But there's some interesting data about this. Now, there's a research done where they gave a description of a workout routine to people. In one scenario, they gave that description to people in a nice, easy-to-read font. In another scenario, they gave it to them in a fancy font, a script font, or like Comic Sans font. They then asked people to estimate how long it would take to finish that workout routine. In the simple font scenario, they estimated the workout routine would take 8.2 minutes. 8.2 minutes. A simple change of the font in the other example, a fancy font, that same workout routine, all that changed was the font. They estimated that workout routine would take 15.1 minutes. Almost double. The type of font people use had a drastic impact on how much work they believed a particular workout routine would take. Now, what's this have to do with the web? Well, when you're using a nice, easy-to-read font and people take a look at it, they're more likely to believe that it's going to be easier to read. So you always want to use a nice, simple-to-read font. But here's where something gets even more interesting. A recent Princeton study found that when dealing with what they call fluent fonts or simple fonts versus disfluent fonts or fancy fonts, there was a drastic difference in how people memorize what you said. So if you want people to remember what you write, a disfluent font, a fancy font, had 86.5% recall versus simple font only like 72%. People were able to retain 14% more content when they read content in a fancy font. Now think about this for a second. How many people have a Kindle? All right. So if you're reading, let's say, on the web or you're reading on a Kindle, the fonts are really crisp. I noticed something about 2 months ago when I got my first Kindle. I was reading on the Kindle and I wasn't remembering what I was reading. And I started doing some research. Apparently, there's a lot of people who aren't remembering what they're reading on the Kindle. Why? There's a lot of people that, and the reason is that the fonts are very crisp. And when you're reading a simple font versus a fancy font, you're actually using a different part of your brain. You actually have to work harder to read a fancy font, which is why it's more rememberable. Now, you're all probably likely thinking, like, how is this guy going to talk about text for any longer than this? And you're probably wondering, how does this actually work on the web? And for that, I want to show you a quick example. All right.
Dude, use Chrome.
One second. You got no internet? Oh,
brand fail. Triggers in your brand, dude.
I fail. No one's gonna want to tattoo my name on themselves if I keep this up, right? Oh, here we go. Sorry about that. All right, so I just talked about thin content versus wide content, fancy fonts versus simple fonts, and an annoying pop-up that pops up on my website. Now, as you can see, it's a regular blog post. All right, I start the blog post with a thin content with an image to the right. The whole purpose of this is to have the first 3 or 4 sentences be in that whole preferable range of content, which is thin content, which it comes down to about 55 characters per line is most preferable for what people want to read. So I thin out my content to start. Now, I then widen the content as people keep reading. This is on purpose. The reason why is direct marketers have long known that if you get people to read the first 3 or 4 sentences of your content, they'll read everything. So your main goal at the top of your blog post is to get people to read just the first 3 sentences, which is why I'm using the whole thin content versus wide content that I just talked about. Now, we were also talking about fancy fonts and simple fonts. How can this be used? Well, if you scroll a little bit further down in a blog post, almost every article I write, I include a simple quote in bold with a tweet this link. And this is known as a soundbite. When you include soundbites in your content, in all of my testing, I've noticed a few different things. First, people are more likely to share the soundbite with their Twitter audience. So in this particular scenario, this article got something like 800 retweets. In most other scenarios where I don't have a soundbite, I only get, let's say, 100 or 200 retweets. A soundbite like this helps people share the content. It gets better. We talk about now fancy fonts, simple fonts. People are more likely to remember harder-to-read fonts, which is why this is all bold. I wanted to make it a little bit thicker, a little bit harder to read. They also remember it, so I did some more testing. When I write articles, I think about sound bites, and I include those sound bites in fancy fonts. After doing this a few different times, I started looking at my Google Analytics, and I started getting a bunch of referrals for people searching my sound bites. One of my good sound bites was like, size 16 is the new size 12. And I get something like 200 searches a month for people Googling this when all I did was put a soundbite in an article maybe a year ago. And people are still Googling this soundbite. They still remember it because I put it in a fancy font versus a simple font. All right, so the end result is when you're writing content on the web, you want to have thin content at the top, and then you want to widen your content as you keep going down your page. Then, always, you want to include a soundbite with a click-to-tweet link in a harder-to-read font, so people are more likely to share your content, referring more traffic and potential customers to your business, and also creating this new soundbite that people are going to remember and attribute to you for the long run. And that concludes what I have to talk about today.
Thanks, Derek. Next up is Brian Clark, who probably doesn't need too much of an introduction, somewhat better known as Copy Blogger, the number one or very near to it, depending on the rankings du jour, marketing blog, the CEO of Copy Blogger Media, creator of products like Studio Press. Brian Clark, take it away.
Hey, everyone. Okay, I just want to tell you a story that kind of ties together what everyone's talking about here. So back in 1944, there was this landmark study performed, and the psychologists basically got together a group of participants, and they showed a short, simple, animated feature. All it was a rectangle with an opening at the top, and out of the rectangle, a circle and two triangles came out, kind of floated around a little bit. And then they turned to each subject and they said, what's happening here? Now, out of all the test subjects, only one person gave the obvious answer, which is, well, that's a couple of triangles and a circle floating around. Everyone else told a story about it. And they told very elaborate stories, these crazy narratives about, okay, so the two triangles are men, the circle's a woman, the bigger triangle's a big bully, the littler triangle's trying to protect the woman, the woman's afraid, and I mean, just incredible stories. There's just geometric patterns floating around on a screen. And, you know, the takeaway from this is what, you know, evolutionary psychologists know firmly, which is we are hardwired for stories. Not only do we love stories of the once upon a time variety, but we are storytelling machines. We tell stories about everyone we know and our relationship to them, how we define people, how we define ourselves. Think about your sense of self. What is that really? Who are you? You know you change over the years, but you always are you. Well, that's because you're telling yourself a story based on the events and experiences and emotions you've experienced over time. You string it together, and that's you, even though you've evolved every year into someone somewhat different. You still get that sense of you. That's a story you're telling yourself. So what's going on inside our brains when stories are happening? Let's talk about explicit stories. There was a study done where we had the brain scanning technology, and I think they were reading a Hardy Boys story of everything. So we've got new technology and old stories. But basically what they saw was that the parts of the brain that lit up during certain actions in the story were congruent with what was happening. So if there was action in the story, the motor neurons would fire as if we were experiencing that movement, that action. When the characters were in an observational mode, then the corresponding part of the brain, again, fired. What's happening is that whenever we're experiencing a story of any variety, we're telling ourselves the story, we're experiencing it, and you get that. That's kind of common sense. But at a brain level, you're really experiencing it. As if you've ever heard the fact that when you're dreaming, there's really no brain distinction between if you were really doing those things. Well, stories are just one step away from that. You're imagining it happening, and you're also placing yourself in the story. Another interesting study from a brain scan standpoint that's interesting for all of you, especially doing content marketing and advertising and all that, is that when one person is telling another person a story and you're monitoring both of their brains, you get what they're called a mind meld. Their brains start firing congruently. So they're sharing the story, they're sharing the experience, and they're on the same wavelength, which is just another testament to how powerful storytelling is throughout our lives. But, you know, if you can get on that same state of mind, in essence, with your content, with your advertising, then you've achieved something really powerful. But the thing about storytelling is that we talk about persuasive storytellings or whatnot. A persuasive story means that the person tells themselves a story that is congruent with what you want them to do. You're never really convincing them of anything other than you're getting them to tell the story to themselves that you want. So in Roger's presentation, he gave the examples of placing people essentially in stories, right? Well, we always do that, and it's usually subconsciously. We're not always aware that we're putting ourselves in the story. But that's why that's effective. It's taking something subconscious and implicit and making it express. So a good advertising story or a good content marketing story is allowing people to tell themselves a story about themselves and about you, your brand, whatever, that is congruent with your ultimate objectives. So one of the Roger talked about how most direct mail fails, and that's true. But one of the most successful direct mail pieces ever was by the Wall Street Journal. Just a simple piece of paper in an envelope with a story. The story was only 4 paragraphs long and 10 sentences. And it basically told the story of 2 guys, went to the same college, graduated together, ended up working at the same Midwestern manufacturing company. And, you know, one guy was the head of a small department and the other guy was the president, right? They set the stage. And then the first subhead, what made the difference? Well, what made the difference essentially was the knowledge that the two of them had come across and what they did with it. And, of course, the implication is the Wall Street Journal is what makes the difference. $2 billion. And they mailed it year after year after year. So what was so powerful about those 4 paragraphs? Of course, we told ourselves a story that made a connection with the Wall Street Journal that, hey, I need every edge I can get so I can be the president guy and not the other guy. So that's not even a real story. That never happened. It was just totally fictional. But it was so powerful that because we placed ourselves in the story, not in the specific story. We put ourselves in that scenario in our own life story. And that's why it was such a powerful story for the Wall Street Journal. It kept working. They kept mailing it. They tried other controls to try to beat it. It always won for a couple decades. So earlier when Derek asked about who was creating content, almost everyone raised your hand. So, you know, so I'm getting that you're doing that in what is the new buzz phrase du jour is content marketing. And so telling stories with your content as a rhetorical device is very powerful, say for in an article, in a video, audio, whatever, you know, just as a way to give an example or to grab attention in those crucial first 3-4 sentences, right? Essentially, that's what the Wall Street Journal ad did. It was just that lead that captured attention and people kept going. but also more explicit kind of stories like case studies that allow people to see results that you provided to someone else. They place themselves in that role, and they're more likely to see themselves solving their problem or achieving their desire with you as opposed to someone else. And we don't have a lot of time to go through this, but we've heard of something called the hero's journey, which was, you know, basically Joseph Campbell said that we had this powerful monomyth that dates back to the beginning of humanity that it resonates with us so strongly. And it's basically George Lucas took it blow by blow and created Star Wars, and I think that did okay. Once you follow this hero's journey, you see it in a lot of the most powerful movies, most popular movies that we've ever had. But it applies to creating content as well, because it's not just using stories in a piece of content. It's the story that's being perceived over time. From the time they first become aware of you to they get to know you, they get to like you, they get to trust you, they're telling themselves a story about you. Now, you know, everyone likes to say in social media, you can no longer control the message, you can no longer control the story. No one's ever controlled the story. You can control how it's distributed, and now you can't. Because now we tell ourselves story, and then we tell our friends on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. So it's really just a distribution medium that's been democratized for everyone. So you've never been able to control it, and you really can't now. But what you can do is guide it. And really what you're trying to do is take someone from not knowing you all the way up into trusting you enough to do business with you. And it's that story you're telling over time is very much like the hero's journey. They have a problem or a desire. They're the hero. They're Luke Skywalker. You're Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're the mentor. You're not the hero. Where brands fail and where advertising fails and where content fails is when you're like, hey, I'm so awesome. No one cares about you, okay? They only care about you once you can help them and once they trust you. So the point is, look into the hero's journey. There's a great book called The Writer's Journey, which kind of explains it all from a traditional storytelling standpoint. But it's a great book for content marketers as well. Because what you have to do from a strategic standpoint is think about, okay, where am I starting with someone? What is their problem? What is their desire? And how do I get them to see that I'm the one who's going to guide them to become the hero and achieve their goals? Think about that strategically, because you can help people tell themselves a story that works for both of you.
As typical for these events, we have our first mid-session tech fail. I'm gonna introduce Dr. A.K. Pradeep, but right now our technical folks are working on resurrecting the South by Southwest laptop here that has Dr. Pradeep's stuff on it. So sorry about that. Can you do it all from memory? I'll introduce you. This is Dr. Pradeep is the founder and CEO of Neurofocus, now part of Nielsen, the ad rating folks. And Neurofocus is probably the most visible company in the neuromarketing space. And I won't talk a lot about the company, but Dr. Pradeep also is the author of The Buying Brain. And, in fact, he'll be signing these shortly after the conclusion of this session over at the bookstore in the convention center. It's about 12:45 that's scheduled for, and then I'll be also signing my book, Brain Fluence, over there about 15 minutes later, 1 o'clock.
Are you killing time, basically?
Well, I've run out of material now, so I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Pradeep.
You know, thanks, guys. Thanks. No, I got the mic. Yeah. So they're going to resurrect this laptop, and we'll see if and when it comes back. First of all, I got an interesting video in there because I thought I'll teach you a little bit of neuroscience, but I'm supposedly the hardcore neuroscientist, and these are all the fun guys. So I think when we get the, I think they're trying to resurrect the laptop and get it out there. But in the meantime, I'll tell you a couple of things. First of all, my friend out there, Derek, was talking about, you know, these fonts work and there are paradoxes, et cetera, et cetera. There are no paradoxes. I actually know the answers to his questions. I wish I had met him before this meeting. So let me give you the couple of answers to his questions or what he was puzzling about. Now, he was talking about, and I didn't understand what he meant by thin paragraphs and thick paragraphs. But finally, I understood what it was. It's very simple. It's the number of saccades your brain and eyes make. So the brain likes to process things vertically like this very easily. When it scans a crowd, it goes, it stutters through a line, right? So if you minimize the number of stutters, the brain loves it, right? So therefore, when you start out with a relatively small sentence, the brain looks at it and says, I can skip through it easily, right? Therefore, it loves it. That's why his thin paragraphs work first, number one. Number two, the wide content later. It's not really wide content. The brain does a very quick scan of how much material is here. Is it a long-ass paragraph? I got it. So if it's really long, I stop. So by making it a little wider, it gives the apparent illusion of it being manageable. That's why it works. Three, why does his little quotations or his sound bites work? It's not really sound bites. What happens is the brain likes what you call pop-out paradigms. If it pops out and it stands different, the brain says, I can spot it, right? Because in a jungle, the brain's looking for the predator, for the velociraptor that attacks from the side, right? So it's just a pop-out paradigm. Anytime you pop out, so if you have a long paragraph or a big paragraph, and you say to yourself, I gotta get my consumer to read the whole paragraph. Nobody's gonna read it, guaranteed. Now what happens is, if you pop a word or a phrase, it could be a different font, a different color, make it bold or whatever, the brain says, what is that? But it cannot look at anything in isolation. Brain needs context. So it reads a little before, reads a little after, and understands it. That's how you get somebody to read something, by popping out things and they get context. Context first and then content, right? So that's the answer to his paradox, right? Now that we have made him happy, then let's figure out how to make you guys happy, right? Now, if the PowerPoint ever came on, and who cares if it comes or not, right? There are just three things I wanted to talk to you, right? I wanted to tell you three key takeaways on social media. And I call it, how does the brain go social? It doesn't go social the way most people think it does. So lesson number one, let's ask, why do people log in to, say, a Facebook? Why do people post on Facebook? I'm just coming back from Beijing. I flew from Beijing and there was a big conversation about Weibo there. Kind of equivalent of Facebook, right? They're having tremendous difficulty understanding the deep subconscious reasons why people log in, why people post. And we found that out, right? Love the background music. The first one, so let me tell you why people log in. And there are just two reasons. There are number, but the top two. The top two reasons why people log in. Number one, I want to know if somebody wanted to become my friend. I'm really disappointed if nobody wanted to that morning. Very interesting, social relevance, right? Number two, we look to see, can I say something? Can I comment on something or post something? Can I express myself? Top two reasons why people log in. You may think it is to look at the pictures of your friends, the birthday parties, the little puppy dogs, right? Not really. Did somebody want to be my friend? And by the way, can I say something? Two top reasons why people log in. Why people post, right? Two top reasons. Number one, appreciate me. You're all going to go back today and say this very funny hardcore neuroscientist was there this morning talking and saying interesting things. You're not writing it because you want to express yourself. You're writing it because you want someone to say, oh my God, what an interesting life you lead. Right? I'm sorry, guys. It's a shameless plea for appreciation, right? Number two, the reason you post, or we post, right? Support me. We are looking for support, right? Now, I'm going to go back and say, you know, I was going to talk this morning, and that bloody computer didn't come on, right? I'm not posting it to offer a fact. I'm posting it so somebody would write back saying, oh, really, Pradeep? I am so sorry, you poor thing, right? Support me. These are the two reasons why people log in, why people post. Now ask yourself, all of the brand building on the social networks, how is it connected, if any, to why people log in and to why people post? If it is not connected, it will be rejected by the social ecosystem. If you find brands struggle and wonder, my God, we don't know what to do on a social network. We have created games, easy part. We can take the faces of people and morph them into cookies and Wonder Bread, right? Easy part, right? That's the easy part. It's the silly part. And this is the point that is hard for us to understand, because a lot of us are building games, building entertainment, building content for the social media, forgetting why people are there in the first place. It ain't about you. It's about me. That's the lesson number one, right? It's not about you. It's about me, right? Number two lesson, all right, as to what do you do in the social media? What brands can do in social media? I say B2B does not stand for business to business. B2B stands for brand to brain, right? Brand to brain is a real B2B on a social network. So ask yourself a fundamental question. How are brands connecting to the brain on a social network? Now, the brain has a lot of episodic things. It looks for context. You say to yourself, well, I got a cup of coffee this morning. I walked in. It is this beautiful room. A lot of people around me. You have an episodic way of processing things. Time is important. Events are important. Contexts are important. That's how the brain looks at things. So now ask yourself, how does a brand talk to a person, talk to the brain on a social platform, aligning with why people are there? Let me tell you how they talk today. Brands today say, you know, would you like to tell me what kind of products you would love to buy? Simply put, I want to make more money. Tell me how I can do that, right? Would you like to personalize the kind of choices that you make so that you could give me more money, right? It is essentially about how you can cough up more dough, right? It doesn't work on a social network. So the important lesson is don't sell, tell. Don't sell. That's not why people are there on a social network. Tell. What do I mean by tell? Not tell you about their products, not tell you about your services. Not about that, right? If Nike was to come on a social network and talk about the beauty of becoming physically fit, not about buying running shoes, inspiring us to become physically fit, right? If perhaps a great breakfast cereal company can come and talk about the importance of nutrition, right? It is telling us things that we need to know that are important for us, right? That is what I call tell, don't sell, right? It suddenly changes the relevance of brands on a social network. So if I was to tell you, there's a lot of important lessons. By the way, is this thing working at all, or are we just... Oh, yeah, it is. Wonder, what a surprise. So really, I don't want to go through my PowerPoint. I'll show you a simple, fun video to take away. But the real important lessons are, number one, remember why people are there on a social network in the first place. It is about me, not about you. Number two, it's very important, B2B stands for brand to brain, connect with the brain, not through the simple, easy things of entertainment, writing boatloads of little games, right? Or taking faces and morphing them into a variety of things. That's the easy part. Nothing to take away. I'm not saying don't do it. is the easy part. That's not brand to brain. It's not really not. You just get a little bit of attention. It's about it. And it will disappear when you're gone, right? How you build a presence is by the third one, which is don't sell, tell. Connect with what we are trying to do through events, through places, through life moments, at the social network, aligning with why we are there in the first place. Those were the three lessons I wanted to offer you. I could do tons of big lectures, but I'm a hardcore neuroscientist, kind of a glorified geek, right? So I shouldn't be doing those kind of lectures. So let me show you a little video that I thought will summarize neuroscience for you, but told in a much better way, a better voice than mine. Yeah? Not that you don't like my voice. I don't suffer from that kind of insecurity, but let's just...
It's halftime. The teams are in their focus groups, discussing what they can do to win the market in the second half. And they won't, because focus groups and surveys don't win. It's halftime in America, too. People are out of work and they're hurting. And they're all wondering what insights they're going to need to make a comeback. And we're all scared because surveys and focus groups and biometrics and facial action coding didn't work. The people of Kodak, MySpace, and Blockbuster know a little something about this. They almost lost everything, relying on tired old insights. But we all pulled together, and now neuroscience is fighting again. The brain is making behavior. We get it now. Occipital C, temporal's here, parietal's taste.
This is a neuroscience piece, guys.
The frontals get attention, emotion, and memory. The mirror neuron system helps understand reach. Through the P300, we understand the deep subconscious. Neuroscience is opening the window of the mind. Brand essence is uncorked. Product iconic signatures are revealed.
Don't you want to have one now?
Packaging wins at the aisle. Advertising gently and tastefully persuades.
The best ad ever made.
Shopping experience is delightful, not draining. Neuroscience and EEG finds a way through tough times, and if we can't find a way, then we'll make one. All that matters now is what's ahead. How do we use the metrics of attention, emotion, and memory? And how do we win? The brain is showing us it can be done. And what's true from that small neurosample is true about all of us. This country can't be knocked out with one punch. We get right back up again, and when we do, the world is going to hear the spark and fire of our neurons. Yeah, it's halftime, America. And our second half's about to begin.
It's called Halftime at South by Southwest, right? It's on YouTube. You can look it up.
Great. We saved the best for last, obviously. I'm always hesitant to invite Pradeep onto a panel because he makes the rest of us look not quite as exciting and engaging. And always brings tremendous props like that video. Listen to Your Brain was from 2 years ago. If you haven't seen that video, it's a neuromarketing hip-hop video. Listen to Your Brain. It's on YouTube. So anyway, we've got about 10 or 15 minutes available for Q&A. If you can, make your way to the microphone here. If not, I will try and get to you. Let's see. Okay, we've got one here.
This question... Hello? Is this working? Okay. This question is for Derek. And I noticed when you were showing your site, right, and you were talking about script, sans serif and serif, maybe. Do you consider serif a fancy font, or is it just, you know, like, is it only sans serif, like Arial and that kind of stuff? Do you consider that simple?
It's not necessary.
Hello? Oh, it's not necessarily the difference between serif and non-serif. It's the difference between script writing and non-script writing.
Okay, okay. And so I noticed that your site, it's the titles are more like Arial looking, and then the texts are more like Times New Roman looking.
Yeah.
Is there some sort of thinking behind that also, or?
Yeah, no, I just like the way that looked.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Thanks.
Okay. Oh, Lord. I have a question for Mr. Clark. You're talking about the Wall Street Journal story being apocryphal, and it made me think: is a beautiful lie more powerful than the truth? When it comes to telling a story?
Yeah, when you think about it, we kind of lie to ourselves all the time. So if you want to look at it from that standpoint. But, yes, I mean, the right story, whether it's true or not, it depends on whether it's true for that person, right? Again, that's how we believe what we want to believe, regardless of trivial things like facts and data. So... yeah, I mean, I think that's one way to answer your question is the right story for the right person really has a subjective truth to it for them.
Thanks for clarifying that, because the there's things like crucial conversations. Have you heard that? It's a way to break up fights.
Yeah, right.
And what they talk about is that you're supposed to not be telling yourself stories. And I've always struggled with that because I thought, well, stories are actually pretty powerful, and I get the program, and it's really helpful, but having that example was kind of cool. Thank you.
No problem.
When you're talking about stories, there are different demographics. I have a product that can be bought by new mothers as well as by retired people, purchased by teenagers and such. When I'm using testimonials, should I try to have a testimonial that a new mother can relate to for the new mother part, that a older person, I'm now retired and I really love this, it works so great, so they can put themselves into that a little better?
Yeah, no, I think so. And again, the beauty of the web is that you can, you know, create, you know, different entry points, landing pages. If you're using pay-per-click, if you're doing content marketing, you can create different, you know, segmented sites for different audiences. But yeah, it's very difficult to have, when you're going after a demographic like that, it's very difficult to have this bland vanilla message that appeals to everyone and offends no one, which means basically no one buys anything. So you have to target people, but sometimes your intuition is wrong. Sometimes you think the obvious matchup between identification doesn't always work. Do you have any, Derek, do you have any good testimonial data on matching up, you know, the reflection of the person back to that demographic?
So less, I mean, that goes with what Roger Dooley was saying. If people see themselves in the ad, they're more likely to convert. Now, if you can't show them themselves, you want to show them someone who they identify with, which is what you're saying. You want to show them that person that they might identify with. Now, you can do it on separate pages, or you can do it on the one sales page that you may have.
Yeah, like they're scanning for the person that is going to resonate. You know, they don't consciously do that, but the one that's persuasive will be the one that reflects them back to themselves. You know, so the Wall Street Journal thing, all that did, you know, they weren't talking to people who worked for Midwestern manufacturing companies. That wasn't the part that people were reflecting back at. It was the success of one man versus another. So,
can I add to that?
Yeah, I was going to see what you felt.
The funny thing is, for the three specific cases you mentioned, the brains are different, right? So the I'm going to stand here. For teenagers, different than the brains for over 60, right? So the over 60 brains have two important aspects. Number one, they can focus, but they cannot, it's very hard for them to suppress distractions. That's what happens to brains over 60. So when you tell a story to an over 60, they can be carried away with distractions and miss the entire point if you're not careful. Lesson number one. Lesson number two, for brains over 60, for some unknown reason, they disregard negative messaging. If your story has anything negative, you can kiss it goodbye, right? So it is not only the form or structure of the story, it's also how you shape it, because the brains over 60 look at it different. New mothers, there is in fact in my, it's not a promo for my book, but there is a chapter on the mommy brain, right? It actually looks and perceives the world a little differently. So when you explain the mommy brain, to explain a story to the mother's to a new mother's brain, there's a certain way you need to shape it, because her brain looks at content fundamentally differently. The teenage brain, on the other hand, is fascinating, right? In that, huge brain development happens from 11 to 14 with extensions to 18. There's a very important fact that most people miss, and that is that the brain development in teenagers is not necessarily uniform, right? That is to say, the prefrontal cortex, the seat of logic and reason, lags behind. It is true, and it eventually catches up. So if a teenager you find is not quite paying attention to the logic as you lay it out for them, they are biologically prohibited from doing that. Right? It's one heck of a good excuse, isn't it? Right? But what happens is, teenagers understand the language of emotion better than they understand the language of reason. So when you try to lay out a piece of content, be it an educational lesson or anything for a teenager, the language of emotion is the one that they understand much better. Right? So even as you create content for these, I would say, vastly different brains, right? Understanding the neuroscience behind how that brain, the lens it uses to look at the content, will enable you to shape it better.
Can I ask you just real quick?
Hi, I have a question for Dr. Pradeep. A lot of the examples that have been given today have been about sort of content optimization and a bit of sort of a content or creative having already been designed and it's making it better. In your video, you mentioned isolating, for example, a brand essence or more sort of exploratory creative work. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about the process that you go through from a neuroscience perspective to isolate something like a brand essence.
Absolutely. We say that the brand essence lives along seven dimensions, right? And they are form, function, feelings, values. These are things that most brand marketeers figure out. Form, function, feelings, and values. The next two things, not most many figure out. The next one are benefits. Benefits are not function. Benefits are things about me I would love to tell you, but I would look stupid if I told you, right? I would love to tell you I'm a very style-conscious guy, right? And you would say, my God, what a horrible thing to, what a vain person he is, right? So I wear a Versace jacket and Russ Bromley shoes to talk to you about it, right? So that's why women carry a Chanel bag with the double C's. Right? So they let the brand talk on their behalf. Right? The next one are metaphors. Benefits are things about me I like to tell you. Metaphors are things about me I like to tell me. Right? And that's the power of a metaphor and their extensions. So it's form, function, feelings, values, benefits, metaphors, and extensions. This is what the brand essence as to how the brain looks at brands. Not how a college professor in marketing would look at brands. There are enough books about that. We look at it as to how the brain looks at brands. So what we do, we use a technique called the deep subconscious response, connected to something called the P300, right? Let me tell you what it is. Let me take a minute and tell you what it is. So if you take Apple, the brand, the three key concepts that Steve, if he was still alive, would say Apple meant was basically cool, user-friendly, and cutting edge. If you look at everything Apple is, you'll probably connect up with these three key things. But then Steve would wonder, that's what I think about it. Does my consumer believe it? Because you don't know what the consumer really believes. But through neuroscience, we want to find the answer, but I do not want to ask the consumer a question. When I ask a question, I already bias your mind. You're thinking about all kinds of crazy stuff, right? So how do I find an answer without posing a question? This is how we do it. We take the words cool, user-friendly, cutting edge, mix it up with a bunch of distractor words. Then I say to Roger, I'm going to flash words on a computer screen. They come and disappear in half a second. You don't have time to think. Some of the words have a red dot on them. Some of them don't. Your job is to find the words that have the red dot. Roger says, that's an easy, stupid task. I'll be happy to do that, right? So every time a word shows up and it's got a red dot, his brain goes, aha, there it is. We call it the aha response of the brain. Technical term, P300, a peak in 300 milliseconds. So fast, he doesn't know it, he can't even control it. The words we are interested in, cool, user-friendly, and cutting edge, will not have a red dot on them. Yet when they show up, if they mean something deep in his subconscious, his brain still goes, aha, and we catch it. So we first baseline him for the words with the red dot and the ones we are interested in. Then I show him Apple, the brand, picture of Steve Jobs, the iPod, the iPad, whatever, right? Do all the stuff. Then I re-baseline him for the words with the red dot and the ones we are interested in that don't have the red dot. The difference from the pre to the post of the words we are interested in, the uptick in them, if any, is due to the brand in the middle. So very clearly, we can track and tease out at the deep subconscious, what did he truly connect with the brand? That's what we call the brand essence, right? And we track it out without asking him a question. And we also measure this over the course of time. Instead of this thing that everybody does called brand tracking, we do deep subconscious tracking of the brand essence to find out what did the consumer truly connect deep inside. That's how you really do it.
Okay, well, I've been informed we are now out of time. Thanks, everybody, for coming out, putting up with a very crowded room.